So today is June 27th, 2015. My name is Tom Martin. We're at my home in Flagstaff, Arizona. And today we're speaking with Doug Rickard. Doug, could you spell your last name for me, please?
Yeah, that's R-I-C-K-A-R-D.
Thank you. And what year were you born and where were you born?
I was born in Denver, Colorado, St. Luke's Hospital, delivered by Dr. Faust. In 1952, March 31st.
What were your folks doing in Denver?
My father had just been transferred there 2 months previously. He worked for DuPont. He was in their petrochemicals division, and he was selling tetraethyl lead to people like Texaco and other big oil companies.
Okay. Did you have any brothers and sisters?
I have an older sister who is 4 years older than I am. I had an older brother who is 3 years older, and I have a younger sister who is 3 years, 4 years younger.
Okay. Did you guys do a lot of camping when you were kids?
Yeah. I grew up after Denver, moved to California, stayed there for a very short time, then North Carolina for a very short time, and then to Long Island, New York. And we would spend summers, as I was growing up, in the Adirondacks and camping at different lakes. I had a great uncle who had a cabin tent on Saranac Lake. That was a cooperative deal with the state. And because I had another great uncle who was chief of staff for Governor Rockefeller, he found out about this special program where you could get the land, and if you put a cabin tent on it, you maintained it, you could keep that for so many years. And that was a nice connection, a great memories from the Adirondacks.
And you were swimming?
Swimming, yes.
Canoeing,
yes. The first canoe trip, I went to summer camp at Camp Lanaquila in Fairley, Vermont. And in 1964, we canoed across Lake Maury through Spider Tunnel, which is full of spiders, and onto the Connecticut River. And we canoed, I think it was down the Connecticut River to Cuckoo Cove. Camped at Cuckoo Cove.
How far?
Well, you know, I was like 11 or 12, so it couldn't have been a huge distance, but maybe, I'm guessing, less than 10, more than 5 miles.
Okay.
And, that was with Pete Gardner, who is a legendary crew coach at Dartmouth for years and years. And French-Canadian, Indian descent. On another trip that year, they broke a canoe paddle. I wasn't on that trip. They broke a canoe paddle, and they were one canoe paddle short. So he stayed up late into the night with an axe and a pine log, and by morning they had a new canoe paddle.
Wow.
And that still stands over the door to the canoeing cabin at Lanaquila with his inscription in it.
Can you excuse me for a minute?
Sure.
I'm going to pause this. We'll cook more gas again. Okay, so canoeing, camping, Adirondacks. How did you start getting west?
How did you start getting west? 1967, tetraethyl lead was on the way out. They realized that they were finding lead samples in the Arctic, and it was coming from gasoline, and they had to go to unleaded fuels, which pretty much shut down DuPont's tetraethyl lead division. So my father was transferred to the Freon Products division. We went from killing the planet with lead to destroying the ozone, and that transfer put us in St. Louis for my high school years, and I had been hiking in New York, a little bit with the Boy Scouts up Slide Mountain, and some with Camp Lanikela. A little more in Missouri, but there really wasn't very many destinations. No place you could go that was not like any other place. You know, hardwood trees and clear-cut forest. So in 1971, when I graduated from high school, we moved. He was transferred to Phoenix, Arizona. And that was pretty exciting because Arizona is a Grand Canyon state. And I look forward to doing some stuff in the Grand Canyon. And got out here and was able to start rock climbing. I had been interested in rock climbing. Have a couple of cousins in New York, Peter and John Fish. John now calls himself John McPherson. And I'd done quite a bit of hiking with them, and they had been doing this rock climbing stuff and some ice climbing in the winter, and I had always been interested in that. A Life magazine article on the first descent of the Dawn Wall by that derelict climber guy. Also did the first descent of the Nose on El Cap. That also piqued my interest. So getting out to Phoenix was an opportunity to start doing more rock climbing. I had done just a little bit in St. Louis with a friend who'd been through an Outward Bound school. We're probably lucky we didn't kill ourselves. But coming to Phoenix, went up to the Nose of Camelback, which is all private land now, and dropping out of the sky was a rope, and then Art Punt came down on the end of the rope. You might know Art, I don't know. Huh? And P-U-N-D-T, he's a teacher, art teacher for years in Flagstaff, and has been around for quite a while. Art came down rappelling off of the bolus and introduced me to the Arizona Mountaineering Club and getting into rock climbing by taking their course. And
did Dave Gansey teach you that course, or who was your teacher for that? Do you remember?
Dave was out of it by that time. He had kind of retired. Bob Box and Phil Martineau, Watts, Bob Watts, yeah, I think it's Bob Watts, and others who were teaching that class then.
Okay.
Got involved with the Arizona Mountain Rescue Team, Arizona Mountaineering Club Rescue Team, and at that time they had jurisdiction over, well, not jurisdiction, they were called by the Park Service if there were technical rescues that needed to be done in Grand Canyon, although I think most of those were probably recoveries rather than rescues, because by the time anybody was able to get up there, good grief, it'd be 8 hours. But the backcountry office then was headed, I think, by a guy named Ernie Kunstl, K-U-N-S-T-L-E, K-U-N-T-S-L-E, and some interesting stuff on him, I'm sure that we'll bring up again later. And for the first couple of years in Phoenix, I spent a lot of time rock climbing, We'd go to Southern California, Tokiets Rock, Suicide, and spent quite a bit of time, you know, really pushing, trying to climb hard stuff.
Was that granite?
Yeah, yeah. Tokiets is a beautiful granite dome, and across the valley is Suicide Rock, which is, at the time, was known for incredibly hard routes and really nice granite. Hmm. Yeah, so there was some granite here, Pinnacle Peak, but not nearly the quality, and Granite Mountain before the Falcons, and but those routes had, I don't know, I just enjoyed Tokiets more. Yeah, so I knew that Grand Canyon was a place that I wanted to go, and finally I got Larry Treiber. By this time I was I working, or I was just about to start working at Desert Mountain Sports, which was a specialty backpacking climbing shop in Phoenix at the time. It was owned by Bill Surrey and Larry Treiber, and Larry and I had been climbing partners for quite a bit. We decided that we would hike down the Boucher Trail across the Tonneau and hike up the Hermit Trail. And Larry had previous experience with Grand Canyon hiking, and I think it's that experience that got us the hiking permit with a ranger named Brian Swift. And I got to know him pretty well. He was great. I could call him up on the phone and he'd say, "Oh, hi, Doug. How you doing? What do you want to do now?" And the deal was that I would drive up to Hermit's Rest. I'd meet Larry there and we would hike the next day. This was a spring break trip around 1973, I think. Well, hopped in my Volkswagen and drove up to Flagstaff and drove out 180. It was dark by then and it was snowing. And out 180 was a little ominous because there was a jackknifed tractor trailer and it had overturned on a Volkswagen Bug, just like mine, except mine was a convertible. And so the back end, just the engine compartment, was sticking out from underneath this overturned semi, and the rest of it was squashed flat. And boy, that's something of an auspicious start to this trip. Drove around that though after the wait for the traffic, and up and out to Hermit's Rest. And it was still snowing. It was accumulating on the ground. Must have been about midnight. Got out of the car and found the head of the trail without any problem. Larry wasn't there. And so I hopped back in my car and slept in my car until first light. And at first light, you couldn't see 20 feet. It was a whiteout. Just snow blowing sideways. Walked around the parking lot to make sure that Larry wasn't there, and Larry wasn't there. And I said, well, if he sees my car, he'll start down. If he doesn't show up, he doesn't show up. And I don't know where the trail goes, but I'll know where the trail went. I can always turn around, go back to my car. And I started down the Boucher Trail from Hermit's Rest, and it was just pretty cool. It was just white out. You know, as you keep walking, more stuff comes into view and less stuff is viewable behind you, but the trail was pretty clear, so there wasn't any problem there. I got down to Dripping Springs, and there were some people camped at Dripping Springs who didn't seem particularly friendly. I just remember knowing that I wanted to move on pretty quick because, having grown up just outside New York City and spent a lot of time in New York City, is didn't appear to me to be a good situation. At least not by myself. So, went down, continued on down the Boucher Trail, which, as I recall at the time, is proceeds along a ledge on the top of the Supai. I think you're down below the Coconino at that point. And the trail wasn't nearly as clear, but there was no place you could go. Either stayed on the on that ledge or or not, and you had to stay on the ledge. And there was tread. I was able to follow the tread because the tread in spots was full of water, so it must have been starting to thaw or, you know, wet rain. And somewhere along that stretch started getting some lightning and thunder. So
what,
we have...
What month was this?
This was spring break. So it was March.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So we have thunder, snow, and that was pretty awesome because you couldn't see anything. It's still a whiteout. Wasn't I could see farther than 15 feet anymore, 20 feet. Could see maybe as far as an eighth of a mile, but I don't think even that far. A few hundred feet, maybe. But the echoes from the thunder up and down the canyon, you know, say, wow, there's something here, but I can't tell what it is. And kept hiking. Got down through the Supai with lots of thunder and lightning. I was told that finding the top of the red wall was key and it might be a little difficult, but I found it without any problem. Continued down through the red wall, and as I recall, you're kind of blocked. There's a cliff on your right side and it's open to the left. It still echoes up and down the canyon, just awesome. And I get down to the bottom of the red wall and I guess out on a little bit onto the Tonto Plateau. And within 15 minutes, the entire storm cleared. It was just spotty clouds and warm sunshine. And here's the Grand Canyon. First time I've seen it in my life from the Tonto Plateau. Just incredible. It's just, wow. So I hike around down into Bouchard's camp. Could have camped at the mine, I suppose, but I didn't. Not sure I knew that it was there, and so I set up my tarp in Boucher Creek, not Boucher. The next day, I hiked down to the river, and it was clear and cloudy and, you know, kind of chances of rain. I think maybe it sprinkled off and on, but it was sunny too. Spent some time doing handstands in the beach, on the beach at Boucher, and watching the river. I don't think any river trips went through then. So the next day I hiked up onto the Tonto, was hiking across to Hermit, and there's a little ravine or a canyon in there where you can see the river, and it was sunny and nice, a gorgeous day. So I sat down there, like, watched the river, and I had lunch, and this river trip pulled up. I think it was Hatch, as I recall, and they had lunch down below me. I had lunch up above them, and I said, that's probably something I should do sometime too, and proceeded on over to Hermit. At Hermit, I found Hermit's camp, of course. I looked for the 32 Ford that Chuck Graff told me would be there, but couldn't find it. I think it had been removed by then. Somebody took it out. It might be the one that's in the museum, the Park Museum. I've heard that there's a 32 Ford there. But, yeah, anyway. If not, somebody else has a pretty nice 32 tea bucket. But in Hermit's Camp, you could see the lower end of the of the cable car, and that was pretty impressive. There's also a little dugout place in a hillside that had a stone front and a door on it and earth over the roof, and you could open that up and go inside. You can't do that anymore, they keep it locked up. But I spread my tarp, 10 by 10 foot tarp, over the roof of that because the weather was threatening again. And I slept inside that little dugout, which was very comfortable. Next night I hiked down to the river at Hermit and saw the first real Grand Canyon rapid. I said, wow, that's pretty impressive. More handstands on sandy beaches, as I recall. And hiked back up to camp. Seems like I'm forgetting something, but I'm... Yeah. Spent the night in the camp, and then next day I start hiking out Hermit Trail. Don't know how long it's going to take me, so I got an early start. And didn't find too much difficulty with finding that trail through the red wall where it's all broken up. There were muddy footprints on top of the rocks, so you know, following a tread wasn't any problem. And I got up to the Coconino, and it really started clouding over. Got up into the Kaibab, which I didn't know these formations at the time. I've learned those since then. But I realized that there were breaks in the geology. Got up toward the Kaibab, got toward the top, and got completely socked in. And for the last mile and a half, 2 miles, snow, white out, he couldn't see 50 feet. Got back to my car and I said, that's amazing. I wonder if they do this for everybody. You leave the canyon rim and the place opens up. And you go back and it's white out. And that was my first trip in the Grand Canyon. Drove back to Phoenix. I think I had to buy a pair of tire chains in Flagstaff at the Texaco station that used to be next to the Denny's, right off of I-40, and drove down the hill.
So Larry didn't show up.
Larry didn't show up.
Okay. Now, was that common for Larry to sort of get things going but then not show up?
I found out later that it was. Yes.
Okay, and then let's talk about Ernie for a little bit. Did you have a permit? Did you get a permit for that trip, or did you just go?
I got a permit for that trip from Brian Swift.
Okay.
And following those trips, I got permits from Brian Swift. But then Brian left, and another ranger kind of took over the permitting office. And her name was Kathy Green. I have a letter at home. I should have brought it. I have a letter at home that I've framed from her. Because when I showed up at the office to get a permit, I was never successful, as far as I remember. I was always turned down. And kind of irked me quite a bit because I had friends who were hiking in the canyon not as frequently as I, but they could get permits for anything anywhere. They had carte blanche, get a permit. You know, Harvey Bouchard, of course, got carte blanche. Other friends of mine who hiked there quite a bit, but less than I did, at carte blanche. But there's no way I could get a permit. And Jim Haggart had the same problem. We showed up one time to try and hike down the Old Hants Trail. No, can't go. Which one was it at first? It's too hot. The summer. Too hot. Oh, well, we're from Phoenix. We're familiar with the heat. Doesn't matter. It's too hot. We went anyway. Hiked up onto Grandview, and in the mine at Grandview, there must have been a ranger because there was a ranger's radio left just outside the mine. So we saw that and said, should we change stations? No, let's just get out of here. Out the Grandview Trail. Didn't get caught. And that's the closest that I think I've ever been to getting caught at anything without a permit. We went back the following winter, and we were going to do something else, but you know, I convinced Jim, hey, let's see if we can get a permit for the Old Hands Trail. No, we've already done that. Yeah, but they said it was too high. Let's see what... Okay. So we tried to get, you know, with Kathy Green again, can we get a permit for the Old Hands Trail? No, it's too cold. You can't hike the Old Hands Trail. Okay, well, how about if we get a permit for, you know, whatever it is we wanted to do? I think it was South Bass. No, the road is a complete quagmire. We have two Caterpillar B9As stuck out there, and you'd never get through. Well, it turned out that the D9A story was... it came up quite a bit. I can't remember what we did, but we did something else without a permit off of the South Rim. We must have done a Grandview to Bright Angel trip, or Grandview to Kaibab trip, which was pretty nervy because without a permit on that central corridor. But they didn't, I don't think they had the backcountry rangers then that they do now. And, you know, I figured we could always claim that we were day hiking, and you know, they would have to prove that we weren't. But yeah, anyway, because on that trip Jim and I hiked down to the river at that old Grandview trail site that drops off of the Tonto, which is kind of different kind of place to get down to the river because the river's quiet through that section. All the other places you come to are rapids, like we did at Grapevine, like I did at Grapevine. And
Doug, how did you meet Jim? Jim Haggart, H-A-G-G-A-R-T? Is that right?
I think it's E-R-T.
Haggart, okay, E-R-T, all right.
Yeah, but I always mess that up. That was through the Arizona Mountaineering Club and his rock climbing. He, myself, and Chris Beal made an epic trip to Yosemite Valley. Geez, on that trip, there was a guy singing at a campfire, and he was pretty good. This is kind of off topic, but got closer and closer to the campfire, and this girl stands up with a guitar and shoves it in my face and says, here, you play, I gotta pee. And so I sit down with this guitar and I'm, you know, fumbling around with it. The guy across the campfire looks a lot like Neil Young, but everybody looked like Neil Young was playing a guitar in those days. And it wasn't until the next day at the commissary where I'm buying orange juice or something, these two girls ahead of me are saying, yeah, wasn't it incredible? He was here. He was playing. And I said, oh, who's that? They said, it was Neil Young was in the campground last night playing guitar. And all I could remember was, you know, when I sat down, he said, what do you want to play? And I said, so, well, let's play something that's not so damn depressing. Oh. And then on the way home, my generator went out. And we'd all rebuilt Volkswagen engines, but this had me stumped. Chris Beale says, I know what's the matter. Pull in here. Give me a dollar. He gave him a dollar. He runs in. The car's going. I got to really rev it to keep it going. He comes running out with this ice cream bar on a stick. He says, eat this, eat this. Take a bite, take a bite, take a bite. We finish it. We get the stick. He takes the stick and he pushes the brushes into the generator. The car roars to life. The headlights come on. So every 125 miles, we had to stop and push the brushes into the generator.
Okay, so you met Jim. Now, Jim was doing some pretty impressive climbing in the canyon at the time. Did you get wrapped up into that with him?
No, not so much. I had an opportunity to do the first ascent on... Buddha. But turned it down for a winter mountaineering trip. I think Larry Treiber was doing more climbing at that time maybe than Jim. Later on, Jim tried to get me, as I remember, to go do the dome with him, and we were just about to do it, and we heard that it had been done. Maybe Glenn Rink bagged that. And, yeah. I've known Glenn since he was maybe 16.
How did you meet him?
When I worked at Desert Mountain Sports, and I think he might have been in one of the climbing classes that I taught for Arizona Mountaineering Club. Not sure. But he was always really gangbusters. Let's go do it, you know. Really enthusiastic guy.
So did you get on any of the Arizona Mountaineering Club rescues?
Yeah, none at the Grand Canyon, but there are a couple of rescues around town that I was involved in. One was at Pinnacle Peak. A guy had fallen and broken his back, and we were able to extricate him and he came through it perfectly fine, no paralysis. I was climbing right next to where he was, so I was right there with a couple of my climbing friends who weren't on the team, and a guy named Dick Webster was climbing around the corner, and Dick did a lot of first ascents at Joshua Tree and was also really involved with the Riverside Mountain Rescue. Chuck Graff once said that Dick could probably take his first aid kit and remove your lung and put it back, and, you know, had the experience to be able to do that. So, you know, the guy picked the right place to fall. We had his head stabilized, and he was immobile in place. We were able to get a backboard up to him after a long period of time and, you know, strap him in and get him to the hospital. A student of mine ran into him hiking around Pinnacle Peak one day, and he told the student the story. The student came in and told me the story, and I said, well, you know, I'm the guy. I was the first one there. No way. Yeah, way.
Yeah. Okay, so after that Boucher Hermit hike, then what were your next journeys in Grand Canyon?
Next one, I think, was a 9-day trip from New Hants to South Kaibab. And that was a pretty cool trip. Hiked and climbed to the river every place we could, and hiked up into the upper reaches of most of those canyons as well. Although I missed the inscriptions in Grapevine. Never saw those. But, yeah, the inscriptions at Hants and those are pretty interesting. And that was in June, very early June, and all the side canyons were running. Cremation was even running, so there was water everywhere. And the temperatures, we lucked out. The temperatures weren't real high until after we got out.
Great. And that was the same, that was also in 73?
Yes, I think so.
Because spring break for the snow trip, and then...
Yeah, it had to be, because I got that permit from Brian Swift, too.
Okay.
And then in 74, I think, is when Kathy Green came in. That was the trip. Oh, my gosh. At the tip-off. Last night, we camped just off the South Kaibab Trail. I think it was legal then, but I don't think it's legal now. And so we were at the tip-off. The tip-off's right at the South Kaibab, right? Yeah, okay. I'm remembering this correctly. We found a lady with her two kids, and her two kids were just having the times of their lives. Mommy, look at this. Mommy, look at that. It was just incredible. And Mommy's going, oh, man. Oh. They said, well, do you need help? Can we be of any assistance? And Mom pointed to the fact that she was wearing these red 3-inch high heels. And she didn't know what to do. She said, I don't know how to get to the rim. One of the kids said, oh, Mom, just click your heels 3 times. But she took off one of those shoes, and they were like straps with closed toe, pointy. And everywhere there was shoe on her foot, there was blister. I mean, blister. Big, thick things that... most of which hadn't popped yet. And she said, you know, thank God you're here. I just don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know how I'm going to get out of this place. And her kids, you know, had not really egged her on, but she had gone on with their enthusiasm, you know, not wanting to squelch any of the kiddie amazement that was going on there. And so I pointed out that there are, you know, different possibilities. We could go to Phantom Ranch and let them know, and they could phone for a helicopter, and that would probably take until tomorrow, and it would probably be her most expensive option. If she could make it to Phantom Ranch, then she could probably stay the night, because at that time they were keeping cabins for rescue, and if she was the first rescue, then... you know, otherwise you may have to double bunk or something. I don't know what they do. And she said, well, where's Phantom Ranch? I pointed down. I said, oh, I can make it that far. And I said, do you need any help getting there? I said, oh, no, I think I can make it. And so she and her two kids went down to Phantom Ranch. And when we were hiking up the next day, we saw them on mules. getting a ride to the rim. But, oh my gosh, I just... The image of those blisters under those high heels. And I don't think she could ever wear those high heels anywhere again, either. You know, just, I think they were just ruined.
So this was 1973?
Yeah.
And how did you get to the river then in 74?
How did I get to the river in 74? 76 was the first river trip.
76, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
There were two friends of mine, Ross Clements and Mark Brown. And they were kind of running surreptitiously, kind of semi-private, semi-commercial trips. They would get permits, and they would supply the gear. You paid them a sum of money, which was more than just cost sharing, and then you had a trip. And it seemed worthwhile to me. I had put in for 1975, and I was supposed to go on their 1975 trip, but as it came up, Bill Suri, owner of Desert Mountain Sports, said, "You're not going, you're working here, I'm going. If you go, you're fired." And there was a time I needed the money to pay for tuition. It was pretty cheap back then, as I recall. 73 was like $125. But, yeah, I had been saving up for that. And so in 75, I didn't go, which is probably a good thing, because the people that went on that trip were, I didn't get along as well with as the people who went the next year in 1976. And the next year in 76, did the same thing. Mark and Ross got another permit. You know, if you got the permit and kind of turned it over to them, then you got to go for free and they would charge everybody else. You had to pay for your own food, of course, but... 76, got back on a trip. Again, Bill came to me and said, "If you go, you're fired. I'm going on this one too." And I said, "No, Bill, I quit." And I went down the river with, and just had a great time with Dave Hansen, who I'd been climbing with quite a bit. And he's done a lot of inner canyon hiking. The last winter, well, maybe I should say something about Dave. Dave is a phenomenal physical specimen. When I first moved to Phoenix in 72-73 and I was in phenomenal shape, I could get to the top of Camelback in 15 minutes. And so could Dave. Well, now, you know, that was when I was 21. Now that I'm 63, it takes me like an hour. Dave can still do it in 15 minutes. And Dave's been doing it this entire time, either Camelback or Squaw Peak. And so, and most of the time he does it twice. And all through these years, the very last weekend that the South Rim is open, he has hiked from the South Rim to the North Rim, stayed at the lodge. Next day, he hikes back. No rest days. Dave doesn't take rest days. And at first, there was a whole entourage that went with Dave. Now, I think most of them drive around to the North Rim and meet him. As we age.
And Dave was on that trip in 76.
Yep. Dave was on that trip with a girlfriend named Sylvia. Ross Clements was on the trip. A guy named Doc Toogood, who had a yellow inflatable banana boat. Who makes those? It's... real common brand. But Doc tried to paddle got to Hants and was thrown out of his boat and almost had to swim sock. Ross didn't pick him up. Ross was waiting for the boat. The dock was kind of wet by the time we got to him. Bill and Leslie Fisher were on that trip. And so was Steve Atwood. There's some other people too. Baby Bear. Some other nicknames. I'd be hard pressed to remember their given names. But that was just an amazing trip. Had a 16-foot Udisco. Had two of those. The Fishers had their own 17-foot Avon. Ross had a 17-foot Zodiac, which is kind of weird, open stern. But he had oars on it and liked it, so hey. And yeah, I think that's all the boats we had. Nobody flipped. Had a great time. Jim Haggart says that he met us on that trip and rode with us to Crystal or Tuna. Met us somewhere around South Canyon. I was thinking that that has to be true. That's got to be the way, because that picture of him and I in that Miwok, which was 1978, he wouldn't have been at Dubendorf in 78 if we'd let him out at Tuna. So, yeah. There you go.
Okay.
Yeah.
And in 1976, were you packing out your solid waste at that time?
No. No.
Were you still building fires on the beach?
Yes. And no. Seems like there were fire pans and you had to deposit the ashes in the main current of the Colorado. So the big black chunks just washed up on the beach anyway. It just scattered them all over. Solid waste was, human waste was deposited in a pit toilet, and blue goo was poured into the pit toilet, and that was becoming a mess. I'd taken another half trip in 76 down. I took a geology of the Grand Canyon trip with, course, with Troy Payway. And Hatch brought us from Lee's Ferry to Phantom Ranch, and I hacked out at Phantom Ranch.
Do you remember that trip?
The fell out of the boat at Hants and held on to the side while the boatman watched me and drove the river. And he said, as long as he could see me, he knew I wasn't in the propeller. He had known plated upside guy.
Shorty
Burton. He had known Shorty Burton, had trained under Shorty, and was able to tell a lot of stories about Shorty Burton.
Who was that boatman?
Oh, I don't remember.
Okay. And what stories did he say about Shorty? Do you remember those?
Cooking incredible pies and cobblers and stuff. And just almost being prepared for about any emergency, you know, always having a cool head. And seems like there was a story about how they pulled something on him, but I can't remember what it is. Some kind of practical joke or something. But, yeah. Bowman kind of stuff. You know.
What do you remember about Peiwei?
Troy Peiwei? Wow. Older guy. Fairly interesting. Some of the graduate students in the class didn't particularly agree with some of his stuff, some of the things he put out. But my impression was that he was kind of an older school geologist toward the end of his career, and these younger guys had newer information or were up on, you know, and Dr. Peiwei just hadn't quite come around yet to the new ways of thinking. But, I don't know, to a point you get that in just about every class.
So Peiwei had written a Grand Canyon River Guide, is that right? From
yes.
Mm-hmm. Lee's Ferry to Phantom.
Yeah, I've got a copy of it.
And he never did one from Phantom down.
No, his geology trips always ended at Phantom Ranch.
Okay.
So, yeah, he wanted his students to be familiar with that section of the canyon, but, yeah.
Okay. That makes sense. And that was also in 76, yes?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so I went twice in 76, the once and done rule.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they had it then or if I was clearly in violation.
They did not. You were good.
Okay.
Yeah. So now you've experienced hiking in the canyon and boating in the canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And how did that impact your vision of the canyon? Were you still like wanting a boat a lot more than hiking? But did you then want a boat more than hike? Or did you want to hike more than boat? Or did you want to keep doing both?
I'll keep doing both. Yeah. Boating is such an incredibly large logistical problem. And it's not really something you can do all the time. Where going up with Dave Hansen, for instance, and doing a day hike, finding the Enfilade Point route or something like that is something you can do every weekend. Yeah, it's a combination of both.
And the Enfilade Point route you did from the rim down with Hansen?
Yeah.
With Beta from Harvey or not?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He was a great source of information, always willing to tell you stuff, and always enthusiastic about, oh, you're going to the canyon? Great! Where are you going? The village? Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's the impression that I had. Hey, you really like it. Yeah. And then Jim Haggart turned me on to his trail notes, which were available through NAU. So at first I could go to the NAU library. Yeah, that's right. Go to the NAU library and I could check them out through their special collections, and they'd ask me who I was and, you know, why I wanted to see these, and without too much resistance I could get all of Harvey's notes for all of his trips. And now of course it's so easy to get them online, but they're not organized in any kind of approachable way. You have to pretty much download and print them all out and organize them by geographic area yourself, I think, to have a serious resource. But they're there, you know, you can get them.
And what do you remember of Harvey, besides his enthusiasm?
Oh, gosh. I went to one talk of his about hiking in the Grand Canyon. I can't remember where it was. But I got there a little bit late and sat in the back. And this group right in front of me, after he went through this just incredible explanation of different things that he was working on during the question-answer session, raised their hands and said, you know, we tried to do your route that goes down behind Cardenas and Escalante Buttes, and it's not there. And you're a liar. And Harvey at first was very patient. You know, he said, no, it's there. If you look for it, you'll find it. And I had just been flown off of that route by a rescue helicopter. And I knew it was there. And they insisted that it wasn't. And Harvey explained that maybe they needed to hike along the top of the red wall a little further and they would have found a break. And they, we hiked the entire, but yeah, when I hiked it with Bruce Grubbs, again, without a permit, the Kathy Green, Ernie Kunzel era, we got down, you have to hike a fairly long ways along the top of the red wall. Harvey writes in a very concise style. And, you know, something like, after you reach the top of the red wall, the break can be found, well, in between red wall and the break can be 3 or 4 miles. Which is kind of cool. I like it. Mm. You know, you have to kind of find stuff for yourself a lot more than other guidebooks. But we'd hiked along the top of the red wall, finally found this beautiful break in the red wall, big gully that goes straight down, gorgeous route. And we stopped for lunch, and I sat on top of these two big boulders, and Bruce sat, you know, maybe 10 yards away. We started to have lunch, and these two boulders I was sitting on were propped up against each other, but they weren't touching. There was a little bitty rock holding these boulders apart. I said, geology doesn't play baseball. How does this happen? You can't. How does that rock get stuck there to hold this boulder apart? So, you know, I was kind of curious. I took my heel and I just touched that rock. And it fell away and bam. I said, oh, that's one of the stupidest things I've ever done. My foot was trapped there and I couldn't get it out. And so finally, Bruce and I, after working on it for a while, he wedged a rock in there, and we were able to chip out. There's two blocks of supai. We wedged a block of red wall in there, chipped out the supai enough so I could get my foot out, and immediately it swells to the size of a basketball. He said, I don't think you're going anywhere. I said, well, yeah, I don't think I can walk on this. He said, well, what do we do? We're not registered. I said, okay, well, you know, I've got a gallon of water. Why don't you hike out and register and then go up to the point up there and signal me with the mirror that you're registered, and then I'll start signaling with the mirror from here for a rescue. I said, okay, we should be good by, you know, about 2 o'clock tomorrow. We should be able to get this all done. So he goes in, he hikes out, goes in, registers for the route. Ernie Kunzel says, oh, whoa, you're going on that route. Ernie happened by. He said, yeah, well, let me show you where it is. He brought him into his office and showed him where the route was, but he had Bruce walking off the red wall at one of the 200-foot waterfalls that we'd already checked out, and the lower part of the route wasn't right either. You just go right here. And Bruce can't say anything. He can, oh, okay. Oh, yeah, I see. You know, once you get, no, that's not it, because I got a friend down there and we're trying to register for him. But he got the permit, and all day they were filming an advertisement for Western Bank, you know, the one that went under with Fife Symington and all that. So there was a helicopter circling around Desert View for most of that morning. And it's that, I don't know if you remember that advertisement where he's talking about the Western Bank and all the good things they do, and at the end they say, "Isn't that grand?" And they pan back and it's Escalante, Cardenas Butte, that part of the Grand Canyon. And I always wondered how they didn't get a little mirror flash in there. But it's kind of weird. A car came and parked at the point at just the right angle, so I got a mirror flash off its windshield. At the same time that the helicopter took off for the village to refuel at the airport. So I'm flashing the helicopter all the way in. Bruce says that he had gotten out, he'd registered and gotten out and was by a ranger with a radio, and the helicopter had radioed in. We got a mirror flash up, you know. And Bruce says, "Oh, that's probably Doug, or maybe this is the day for rescues." The helicopter goes into the village, refuels, starts coming back out. I start flashing it again. It turns, you know, flies straight down. We have taken the little saddle and put a huge triangle on it, dug in the dirt. They pull up. I throw some dust in the air to give them an indication of wind speed, but they didn't need it. They just hovered there for a while, figured it out, landed. Guy came, put me in the left seat, actually. He was flying from the right seat, and threw my pack in, took off, up to the rim. And the way this guy flew, you know, he flew right into the wall, knowing that there's an uplift on the wall that'll carry him up and over, rather than, you know, putting more juice to it. Just as you're going, "Oh my God, this, oh, okay, I see what you're doing." And that was my helicopter tour of the Grand Canyon.
Where did he fly you to?
He flew me to the I think they asked where my car was, and I told them. And they flew me right to there. And because I said, you know, I can get myself, I don't need a ground ambulance. I can get myself to the clinic from there. And so they let me out, and insurance picked up the tab for the helicopter rescue, or the emergency transportation. Hmm. So it was a fairly cheap air tour of the Grand Canyon.
Did you break your leg? Was it just superficial damage?
A lot of soft tissue damage, a little bone chip, and boy, it took a long time to heal. Hmm. Maybe 6 weeks or more. Hmm. Yeah, and then it hurt for quite a while when it got tired, you know, hiking on it. But
okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. It's pretty good now.
Yeah, good.
Same leg as my knee. My new knee. Matter of fact, I think I still have. Yeah. Right here.
Yeah, there's a little bump right there, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So it really cut your foot, not your fibula and tibia up above.
Right.
Your ankle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just smashed your foot. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. Wow. That was lucky.
Above where my foot, you know, is wider, so it's a perfect jam crack. Might have been able to get it out if I'd really pulled on it, but with a lot more damage.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So as our time is cruising along here, what were probably one of the one or two most amazing things you've seen in the Grand Canyon in your time there?
Oh my gosh. Well, the canyon, of course. hate to say the F4 Phantoms that used to fly through. But they used to fly through below the tapetes. They used to fly through below the inner, in the inner gorge. Right? You familiar with that? Yeah. And I used to throw rocks at them. One pilot saw me. It took evasive action, of course. I'm throwing, you know, 100 feet, and he's a mile over there. But there was one as well that came. I had just started down Tanner, and one came over the rim with his engines pretty much out, just coasting, making a whistle sound that I'd heard once before when a Golden Eagle had flown past me in New York off the escarpment trail. And it sounded just like that. I'm looking around, except this one's getting louder and louder and louder, getting really loud. And then here's this F4 just above the treetops, falling into the canyon. And he got down to as low as I guess he wanted to go, and fired in the afterburners. And they can't go vertical like fighters can do today, but he was as steep a climb out of there as he could possibly. Like a blam, blam, and that echoed up and down the canyon. And I remember thinking, you know, wow, that's the same echo that I got on the first trip with the thunder. And working at Desert Mountain Sports, we used to have fighter pilots that would come in, and I asked one of them, you know, hey, you know, what are you guys doing when you're flying through the inner gorge? He said, well, we have those recon cameras on, and we take pictures of the entire length of the Grand Canyon. We're not supposed to do that, but we take them to the photo guys, and they develop them for us, and we put them up all around, you know, our living quarters.
Wow.
And so there have to be copies out there of F4 recon photos of the entire length of the Grand Canyon.
Wow.
And I said, well, how can you do that? He said, well, and this is like 1973-4, right? This is, there's detente, but the Cold War is still pretty serious. He says, well, we're not supposed to, but they can't keep track of everybody. I said, what do you mean you can't keep track of everybody? Can they keep track of the Soviets? I'm hoping. Yeah. The Grand Canyon is just so amazing that it's that kind of human thing that makes you realize what the scale of the canyon is. You know, for it to be so large that a fighter jet can just fall into it for the amount of time that he did. And I'm sure glad his afterburners worked. Or he'd have a smoking hole off of the Tanner Trail that would still be there today. And you know, the natural thing that amazes me, I think I kind of agree with Powell when you're down by lava where the cinder cones put all that magma into the canyon, and just thinking about that, blocking it up and creating what must have been a pretty sizable lake. Just all of those natural forces at work at the same time. It's just, it's really mind-boggling. Oh. I drove out to Swamp Point. It took me a couple of days trying to figure out the road back there, because it was before the days of GPS, and you know, you'd get so far and a tree would be down, and I didn't have a winch on my vehicle, and I didn't have a chainsaw, so I'd have to back up and turn around and try to figure out some other route. I finally got out to Swamp Point, and that was a real disappointment because about every 15 seconds there was a plane flying through Swamp Point. But I hiked down to the bottom of the saddle, and there's this little CCC cabin there that's full of tools, or was at the time. And that was kind of cool. But I hiked back up to the top of Powell Plateau, and the trees there were just incredible. Not like ponderosa pine you find anywhere else. It's just bigger than you can reach around, and maybe 6-7 of them per acre, and just monstrous things. That was pretty amazing experience. And thinking that, gosh, the entire Mogollon Rim could be that prior to cattle or whatever it was that started the current fire succession. You know, most of the trees on the Mogollon Rim are from 1919, as I understand it. And while that's almost 100 years, they still mostly have black bark, where mature trees have that more yellow or golden color. And these are all old growth trees, just pretty impressive.
Cool. So, last question. 75 years from now, somebody's going to listen to this recording.
I'm sorry.
What would you like to tell them about Grand Canyon?
Well, I hope it's a place that still exists, that it hasn't been sold off by the more conservative members of our political structure and turned into a profit-making short-term enterprise. Because if that's happened, boy, you sure missed out on something that was really wonderful. It's a place that always seemed like home. I go up to the Grand Canyon and look over the rim, and it's just John Muir's words about go to the wilderness and get its good tidings. Your cares will fall off like autumn leaves. I don't remember the quote, but it always feels that way. It's always a place that's neat to know, despite what's happening in my job when I was still working, or with other relationships, or all the other stuff that goes on in life. You can go to the Grand Canyon and just take a breath, have a break, enjoy nature, see something you've never seen before, and come back refreshed. Renew your attitude. Come back to the problems that exist, that exist in your world, with new vitality.
Cool. Well, Doug Wickard, thank you so very, very much for this interview today. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's been fun.